Hi, and welcome to the new episode of Dev Propulsion Labs, a podcast where we talk about the business of developer tools. I'm very excited to introduce today's guest, José Valim, creator of Elixir and many products around it. First, I want to start with a big question that I think many aspiring developers and technical founders face. When you find a problem or an interesting challenge, how do you find strength and confidence to actually do it?
I am mostly trying to build things that I would use myself and that I want to use. So there's like this very selfish view that I am building things for me. And the word confidence is interesting because I wouldn't say that I am like overconfident, but it doesn't necessarily cross my head in the sense that I know those things are challenging. But the challenge is like almost all the fun that is in there. You know, it's like, oh, is this going to be challenging? I'm going to learn a lot. And for me, that's like, that's why I want to do it, right? So I think like if it was not challenging, so for guessing, but like, oh, imagine that I have this idea for this new thing and I don't think it's challenging or it would be exciting, or I would not use it, then I would not do it. Even though it's like, oh, somebody's going to say, you're going to make a lot of money like that. They're like, nah, if I won't use it, it's not exciting. What is, you know, what I'm actually going for?
Do you ever have fear that, what if it's not possible to actually solve this?
Like, so for example, going back to Elixir.
Yeah.
So first, I didn't start with the purpose of creating a new programming language. I wanted to learn. I don't have like a computer science background. So I was like, I actually want to understand how programming languages work. I think it's going to be useful for me. I am a programmer for my career. And then as I did it, I was figuring out like, hey, I can actually have something unique, something that you can do things that you couldn't do before or you can't do elsewhere. And that eventually led to the language. And I first built a prototype, which was horrible. And then I did not do anything for like 8 months. And then I came back to it. And at that point, I was working at Plataforma Tech, which is a consultancy in Brazil. And I reached out to my co-founders and I asked like, hey, can I work on this part-time? And I was very clear to them, like, this may not work, right? Like, I can work on this, like, it's a huge project. I can work on this for like 3 years and have nothing to show for it. But like when we go back to the things, like I'm doing something that I want, I'm doing something for myself, I'm doing because I'm learning. If it doesn't work, it's fine, right? Because the learning, the experience, the fun of doing that, it's going to be there regardless if it works or not.
So building a language, creating a language from scratch is a very challenging business model.
Also,
it's very hard to get people to adopt your new language. It's very hard to understand the commercial side of things, especially when you're just starting out. Did you think about those things beforehand? Or this was kind of like, okay, if I actually manage to do the language, then I'll think about those things.
I thought about those things as like difficulties, as challenges, but not necessarily from the point of view of like, oh, we have to think how we are going to solve those things up front. So I knew those challenges were there, but I was not making decisions focused on them. Because for me, it's like, if I'm writing a programming language and if I'm making decisions, I want to make what are the best decisions for the programming language, the best technical decisions. And of course, adoption is part of the equation. But if you have to balance what I would consider to be the best technical decision and adoption, right, I would stay with the best technical decision. Because otherwise, it's very easy for you to just like do the decisions focused on adoption, which, especially when you're early on, like adoption is a lot of guesswork. And then you end up with a lot of wrong decisions, or adoption changes with time. So as an example, like at the beginning when we started Elixir, we were talking like functional programming was a very hot topic, mm-hmm. and Elixir is a functional programming language. And that was very useful to adopt Elixir because functional programming languages were a hot topic and Elixir is one. But today, functional programming is still useful, it's still important, but it's not like the hot topic of conversations, mm-hmm. right? So if I, basically what I'm trying to say is like, if you're trying to chase adoption, adoption is a moving trend, mm-hmm. and that can lead like maybe could lead to a language that is not polished because as time changes, the trend changes and then what you are building to the language is going to change. But if you're thinking about, look, I am doing like the best technical decisions, mm-hmm. the hope is that those are going to be way more stable mm-hmm. over time, especially when you are building like one key aspect of Elixir is that we are building on the Erlang virtual machine mm-hmm. that exists for like four decades or almost four decades, which has been stable, right? So we are building on something stable, and I want to continue leveraging that stability and the goals that they have set for them like four decades ago.
Name some companies that use Elixir.
Mux, Remote, Superbase, Fly, Discord, Apple, Toyota, BBC, PepsiCo, Mozilla, and many, many more.
Now looking back 13 years ago, you know, that's a decade. Looking back at your journey, were there any key decisions that led to great adoption, like Phoenix or something else that you can actually point out and say, oh, this was a pivotal point for us where things took off? Or
there are several things. Phoenix is definitely one of them. So when I started Elixir, I was coming from the Ruby and Rails world. So I knew like the web was going to be part of Elixir. Right? Like people are going to use Elixir for doing web stuff. And I knew it was a matter of time for somebody to come with the right vision mm-hmm. for it. Because that's the other thing, like, so I said, like, when I did Elixir, when the first version was really bad, because our first intuition when you get to somewhere new is like, let me bring the stuff that I know, mm-hmm. right? Let me bring my habits, let me bring my practices. And then, of course, that's important, but it takes time for you to say, okay, I brought that stuff, but that's actually not the best way of doing this here. Like, mm-hmm. there are maybe assumptions, there are things that you need to reevaluate and ask again, and that it's a process that can take time. Mm-hmm. So going back to Elixir and Phoenix, there were a lot of, very early on, there were a lot of web frameworks, but a lot of them were just bringing ideas from different places. Mm-hmm. And Phoenix was the first one to ask, well, what would be if I am like building something that is going to leverage everything that's in this technology, mm-hmm. right? So it's built for like real-time systems that are communicating and exchange information, which is basically a lot of the software that we write for the last decade. So that was definitely important. I think using the Erlang virtual machine, so it was very important. It was part of the decision process. I wanted to use the Erlang virtual machine, but the thing is that when you're targeting something that exists like the Erlang virtual mm-hmm. machine, because if you are writing a programming language, there are mm-hmm. so many decisions that you can make, right? And it's really, can be really challenging, and having a really big problem space can add a lot of time to the development of the language. And when you say, look, I'm going to target like the Erlang virtual machine or the Java virtual machine, it reduces that space mm-hmm. that is really useful. And you're also building on top of somebody else's work, mm-hmm. right? So Erlang is maintained by Ericsson and they have a big team. So they are constantly improving it and I get to leverage it. So that was a very important decision early on. And then Phoenix was important as well. And something that I knew from my experience going back to Rails is that marketing is extremely important. Hmm. Like developers don't really like to think about marketing. We have like this idealistic view that, oh, if you build the best technology, it's just going to work. People are going to come. And I strongly disagree. I think having a solid technical foundation, it's very important for you to convince like other developers, mm-hmm. technically minded people. You know, the decision process in a company, you know, can go many layers. So I knew it was very important for me to go reach out to developers, reach out to CTOs, talk about the language, about the experience, go to a bunch of different events. Mm-hmm. And that was key as well. And what that helped is that quite early on in the language age, we were able to have like influential people interested in the language, like Dave Thomas, who was very active in the Ruby community. He was one of the signers of the Agile Manifest. So he wrote a book for it. And then early on, we had people writing books, doing screencasts. And that was very important for us to get like interest going, people investing into the language as well.
Yeah, you've managed to create this huge community around the language, and it seems to be a thriving, a healthy one. What would you say is the secret to success, to keeping those healthy boundaries within the community, maybe decentralizing it?
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly the word I use. If we go back to 2022 and the languages that were coming up around that time, right, it's Go, which is backed by Google. Swift came a bit later, backed by Apple. And then you have F#, you have Rust that was backed by Mozilla. And those are all several orders of magnitude have more resources than my company had at the time. So for me, it was very clear since the beginning that we had to be decentralized. Mm-hmm. And I tried to bake those ideas in how the community operates and into the language as well. So the language design has to be extensible. People should be able to get Elixir and bring to different domains without relying on me or a team to give the direction, to add affordances. So like today, we use Elixir for web, distributed systems, machine learning, data processing, embedded software, right? And some of those, like I have no idea how it works, right? So my job is to make sure that they can get Elixir, that I'm not getting in the way, mm-hmm. right? That's the most important thing. I am not getting in the way. The language is not getting in the way. They can go and do what they need. So that's in the language and also how I think about the community, right? Like, oh yeah, if you want to do embedded, you don't have to ask me, go and do it. You want to do an event, go and run the event. The fewer things I am involved with, for me, it's the better, right? That's where I want to be. And I know there are some things that require, so what I've been working on for the last 2-3 years is a type system, which is very important. And I understand that needs to be like centralized and be part of the language, but that's the exception mm-hmm. to the rule.
How do you make sure that the language kind of like doesn't get out of control? Like, okay, there's so many moving parts, so many people contributing to it, it's growing, it's evolving. Do you feel that you gotta kind of like control it somehow, or you just let it run where it runs?
Yeah, I would just let it run, most likely. So for example, when Phoenix came, mm-hmm. eventually I got more involved with Phoenix in particular, but I started talking to Chris and I gave feedback. So sometimes I give like feedback, oh, I would do this thing differently. But I try to be very careful with that. I mean, understandably, it's very easy for people to take what I say and mm-hmm. like, oh, that's the way it should be. Which for me, it's not honestly fun. I'm way more interested in having a discussion mm-hmm. about those things, right? So I try to be careful on how I approach those. I would way more prefer to be surprised than to get something that I'm expecting.
When we talk about developer marketing and marketing to developers, I mean, there are certain kind of rules that don't work in developer marketing, you know, that salesy kind of like yeah. stuff just doesn't work, right? Do you have a recipe for what does work?
So I have this saying, which is, because a lot of when we're discussing technical things, it's very easy to fall back to opinions on the mm-hmm. discussion. And I hate that, right? And I like to say, look, if all we have is opinions, I prefer mine, right? That's very easy, right? Like problem solved, right? So when I'm making decisions about the project, about the language, I am making technical decisions where I can pinpoint the trade-offs, mm-hmm. right? I'm saying, look, I'm doing this because this is better for this and this and that compared to those other approaches. And that's my marketing material, right? I can go and say, look, here's why you would want this for these exact things, and here is what you're going to get back. And I can show it to you in many ways because you can see those design decisions in the language or in the projects that I work on. And then if that resonates with you, then, you know, my job is done. So that's how I approach it. And it works really well for selling to developers, right? So I'm good at creating and selling developer tools because the process for me is one.
It sounds like dog fooding is kind of the integral process of creating, right? Like you yep. need something that you actually would use so you can market it honestly and, you know, showcase the benefits. Yeah.
And also, not necessarily that I use, but also that I would use yeah. also works because this is an aspect of like me being curious and trying to find different things and then applying that process to new areas, mm-hmm. such as like, well, you know, oh, if you can use Elixir for machine learning, what is going to be the trade-offs there? And that's a whole new area. I can think about the problems there, understand the trade-offs, and then go back and explain. And through that process, build the tool that I would like to use with the rationale of why I would like to use it.
Yeah. So analytics is kind of like an unsolved problem in open source. You don't necessarily know how many people use it. Yep. You don't know how people use it. You don't know any bottlenecks, nothing, you know? With the language, I assume it's a bigger problem.
It's bigger because all the different ways you can install Elixir. And a lot of them, those are, you know, like it's part of an operating system distribution. Yeah. And we don't have the metrics, we don't have the access. And the other thing that also applies to Elixir and open source in general is that actually most of the traffic is coming from like CIs, from like test servers, yeah. where everything is automated. So you're effectively measuring how frequently the machines are going for that and if there is a cache somewhere. So it's really hard. And then there are some things that are, it's not necessarily agreed. So for example, one of the ways that you could measure is like, well, activity on Stack Overflow,
yeah.
which today it's probably becoming, because of AI, it's probably becoming less and less relevant, right? So activity on Stack Overflow, but even then I would say, well, it's kind of like, if you have good docs or if you have other places where the community can reach out, you're not going to be active on Stack yeah. Overflow. So you can be punished for doing a good job, which is yeah. not necessarily a good thing. So what I use usually as reference is statistics from GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
So how many repositories, what is the activity of commits, pull requests? That's something that gives us like a good idea of where the language is. And then sometimes there are like some surveys. Mm-hmm. So I think the most popular one's going to be the Stack Overflow survey, where Elixir came up, for example, as the second most loved. They changed the word between editions, but it came out like the second most loved programming language, which is, it's a nice, really nice vibe check.
Mm-hmm.
Then Phoenix came as the most loved web framework. But for example, even that, like when that came out, of course, I was very happy. But one of the things that I'm actually looking forward is to have that loved, I think the numbers were really high about people who loved it. I actually would like to see it come down because it coming down a little bit, it means there is more adoption because mm-hmm. I think those are also intertwined. Like at a point, because a lot of people are like, oh, I am at my job doing this thing and I don't like it, right? That's happening because, well, they are kind of being forced into that position,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you are in a scenario where everything is loved, it's a comfortable scenario
mm-hmm.
and you need to have a little bit more tension. More friction, more mm-hmm. tension. But overall, like we can look at some things, can have some indicators, and then other things like macroeconomics can mm-hmm. be like, you know, COVID was a boom and now, you know, everybody for the last 2 years made way more skeptical about technology in general. Yeah. It's not an Elixir thing. It's rough, yeah.
Do you do anything special to nurture new companies, new startups to start using Elixir in their, you know, writing in Elixir?
So we do in the sense that, so when I started Elixir, so Elixir is like a functional, concurrent, distributed programming language. That's how like some people will describe it, which is not what most people are coming from. It's not what they're necessarily learning at mm-hmm. university.
Mm-hmm.
It's not why. So since the beginning, it was very clear that, well, we need to have a really good getting started experience, because it's going to be a learning curve. And if we make things steep when they are not necessary, that's not going to, to be positive. So we have always worried about, concern about that, to make sure that the onboarding experience is good, and then having good material, because, well, okay, maybe a developer is going to get started with Elixir, but what it's about for the company to adopt it, and what are the practices? So we also have to be very upfront about that. What are the tools that you can use? How the team is going to use it together? And it's actually interesting, because a lot of these became, you could see in the evolution of the language as well. So one of the things that Elixir has, which other languages also have, is like a built-in code formatter. And the reason this thing came to life is because more people are starting to use Elixir, and then the teams, they were starting to fight, like, oh, this is how you should write your code.
Yeah.
And then people came to me like, oh, tell us how we should write your our code. And I'm like, why? It's like, not why, like, I don't get, but like, why me? Like, you know, like, have your team talk to each other and kind of figure out. But everybody was like, no, it should just be a unified thing. So, you know, there are no sort of discussion. And that's something that we added to the language. And for me, it was very clear that it was like a part of the adoption process. As now you have, this was probably almost a decade ago, but as you have like teams using it, you start having requests for different things, for team-centric solutions. And we have always had our ears open to what those pains, what they could be and how we could address them.
What are some fun things you got to do in San Francisco?
I went to the AI startup school by Y Combinator, which was definitely interesting. Then got to visit Apple. That was fun. That was a great meetup, Ruby Elixir meetup, organized by the Evil Martians and Planet Scale, and to record a podcast.
We work with startups a lot. A lot of them are developer tools, and some really loved ones like Superbase, Fly.io, Remote, they're all built on Elixir. Are there any efforts that you pursue when you support teams like that in building on top of it, especially when it means a huge community that onboards onto your language?
I think it goes back. So there are a couple of things that we do. So we go back like to the, you know, making sure that the experience in the language is as smooth as it could be, writing materials, still going to events. And that's like a community effort. There's something in particular that I do with my company, which is Dashbit, is that we have this Elixir development subscription program. And the idea is that, well, if you're a company and you're adopting Elixir, whatever technology is very common to have questions, especially when we can answer, like a language can answer, can talk about, we can have documentation, we can have guides in the general sense, but when it comes to applying that to the particular domain that you're working on, that's when the questions will start to arise. And so that's something that we do more like hoping to help companies adopt. And like some people would think about it, oh, you know, like, so you are creating a business so you can sell support. For me, it's actually kind of the opposite, because a lot of the times when the client asks us a question, what I would do, and it's the same if somebody asked me on like Elixir forum or, or anywhere, you can find many examples of this. People ask me a question, and then instead of answering them, I actually go, I change the documentation, and I point him like, here's the updated documentation. Does that answer your question? And we also use that at work. So a lot of the things, it's really good because we can see where the friction points are. So there are like, there are whole open source projects that we created because we saw friction points in adoption when working with those companies. And then we got those and okay, we have to solve it. Maybe it's documentation, maybe it's a series of guides that we have written, maybe it's a new project.
As consultants, I understand what you're talking about, because we see that same journey over and over again, you know? We understand what could be the more difficult parts of the journey, and as people who kind of, it's like changing a tire for the first time versus when you hire somebody who's done it 100 times, you know, it's a very different situation. So I totally understand. And I want to ask something about the current situation, because right now we're in San Francisco and we're in this bubble that is fizzling with excitement for AI. Everything is about AI. Historically, you've been remote, right? You have never lived in San Francisco, right?
Or maybe no. Yeah.
Do you feel the pressure of this, I would say, technology front emerging, or even the way the technology is built is transforming? Does it affect Elixir in particular? I understand that you have a new product, Tidewave, in this space, but speaking of Elixir specifically, do you feel that pressure?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. And I don't necessarily feel pressure, but it has been so interesting in that people, they have concerns is not the correct word, but there's like some anxiety in general, not really about Elixir. So when we started doing things more related to AI, like Tidewave, a lot of people actually reached out to me. I was not worried about this. I was not feeling this pressure. But people reached out to me like, oh, thank you for doing this. And the reason was not like because they were happy with the project, but because them seeing that people like me and Chris McCord, we are not dismissing AI, gave them like some insurance, which is it's a very interesting feeling. I usually not like, based on everything we're talking about, like, oh, about Elixir being decentralized, I don't really like leadership. I understand that people look at me in a position of leadership. I understand that what I do is going to affect their work and their day-to-day. But the whole point is that you should not depend on me, right? As a community, like the community should be bigger than any person in that community, right? If it's not working like that, it's because something is wrong. So I usually, like when people are asking me like, how should I do this? I'm like talk between yourselves and figure it out. Like, I don't know, like I may not have the best answer. And this was one of the times where I felt the opposite. That was like, huh, I understand my position of leadership and I felt that I was actually bringing value and comfort, not in a way that like I'm being a clutch that being relied on, but helping, you see what I mean, right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of a new recent experience for me. But yeah, like with everything happening with AI, there's still a lot of questions, but I don't feel pressured. I mostly feel like I am curious about like the opportunities that are there and how that's going to impact me. Right. And then working on the language and seeing the AI tool. So that's why I'm working on this project called Tidewave. I see like there is a gap. Right. And for some time, I have been like knocking on people's door, like people who work on editors or on AI tooling. It's like, hey, you should do this. And people have not been listening to me. So understandably, possibly busy with other stuff. And then I'm like, OK, I'm now Anthropic. They released like MCP about 6 months ago. And now I'm like, okay, I finally have the tools to do it myself. So I'm starting to explore it. And, you know, what does it mean to be, in particular, what does it mean to be a web developer now with AI? How does that affect our tool? Because we have AI that is working inside the editor. But sure, I write code, but that's not the value that I deliver. If I write the code, but my user experience is horrible, right? Like the value of the code is going to be greatly diminished by that, right? So I have been thinking about those things, right? So how our tooling is going to change and how we can adapt, how we can make AI better integrated with programming languages, with our web frameworks, and also a little bit of like envy. So for example, there are like websites like Bolt and Lovable that they bring like that experience, like, oh, if you want to write like a front end, a web framework, you get that initial experience. And I'm like, look, I want those tools. I want those tools for Rails, for Phoenix, for Django, right? And I want those things. And I don't want somebody else to own my code. I want those things running on my machine. I want them part of my day-to-day tool, like it's an editor or anything else.
Yeah. What do you envision as the future for Tidewave? Do you have a bigger vision as to where you're headed?
So I think we are way more on the exploratory stage, right? In my head, what I see is that I can see us having more. So like going back to the editor it understands a different language, but it only looks at the code.
Mm-hmm.
But development in general, there are like so many verticals, right? So I'm thinking like, look, we need to have specific tools for app development. And then if you're a company, like, and you work on a game engine, you want to have specific tools for the game engine. Like, because otherwise you are doing this translation job all the time. Like, you see something happening in the page, and then I have to go to the AI and like, oh, this is what was happening. Help me fix it, right? I think we need to bring the tools higher and to a higher level. And I see this happening across things. Like, if I'm building on a game engine, something weird happened.
Yeah.
I want to point at that thing, like, why this is happening. I want to ask the questions on the thing that I generate,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily on the code. And I think that is going to open up a lot of possibilities. So that's like, thinking about vision, that's my vision for, mm-hmm. you know, for like, for dev tools. We are going to start seeing more higher and higher level tools.
Yeah. As a technical partner of Stack Blitz behind Bolt.new that you mentioned,
yeah.
we saw their transition from a developer tool, a professional tool, to something that anybody could use. You know,
yeah.
anybody can create an account in Bolt.new and spin up an app. Do you envision crossing that from professional tooling, developer tooling, to something that just any person would use?
So for Tidewave in particular, again, may change in a year, but now, not necessarily, because it goes back to I'm writing the tool that I want to use,
yeah.
and I'm going to use. So that's where my head is now. Maybe in a year, it's like it's a huge success, and now we can envision more of that. Hey, is your first day with Elixir? We are going to help you. But at the same time, like today, it was actually announced Phoenix.new
mm-hmm.
From Chris McCord and from Fly,
wow.
which brings that experience. So you go, you sign up, and then you have this remote environment where you just start writing your Phoenix application. And the best thing about it is that, so it has a whole remote environment, but it really understands Phoenix and what makes Phoenix great. So we were at ElixirConf about 2 months ago, and we were demoing it. And then I just asked, like, hey, please do Uno card game.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then it was a one shot. It came up with a game working. And then we were just playing around the table with our phones.
Yeah.
Because it's using, like, the Phoenix strengths for building, like, real-time collaborative applications. So I don't see myself doing that, but I'm really happy that Chris, for example, is looking exactly into that thing and having that more integrated experience where, like, oh, you do everything online, right? There's a remote environment somewhere. You click a button, they deploy it for you, right? And I'm rather thinking about all those other developers like me who still want to own things in their local environment, control things in their local environment. And it's like, hey, we also deserve a cool experience like that.
Yeah.
Like, we also deserve all of those tools. And I want to have them here on what I use on my day to day.
We talked about the future a little bit. I want to wrap up here and I want to ask this question. If you were to encourage people to try Elixir today or somehow get engaged with Tidewave, what would your message to developers be?
I think keeping with the theme of this conversation is like, don't listen to what I say, right? Is if you enjoy those things, like,
try
it out, right? Figure for yourself. There's like a bunch of material out there. And join the community. There are a bunch of places where you can ask for help, interact with people, and see what you love about it. I think we have a very clear message. So for example, if you're doing web dev, like, what is the kind of things that you can build with Phoenix and not really with anything else without doing like 3 times, 5 times more work? If you want to feel productive building anything that is real-time, collaborative, go for it. And just one parenthesis, like, the nice thing about the real-time collaborative, so here everybody talking about AI, my friend said that I should come with a t-shirt that said, Elixir is the best programming language for building AI agents, and then like ask me why. And the reason for that is exactly because agents, they are real-time
yeah.
collaborative, right? They are all those machines running, right? and communicating between them, exchanging information, right? And sometimes communicating with the user, right? And then if you're building this in any technology, there's so much infrastructure you have to bring to make that work. You have to bring the message queues. While with Elixir, everything just talks to each other. It's part of the language. So if you are in that space, I think you're really going to enjoy it and have a great experience.
And my last question that I ask every single guest, it's called a warm fuzzy question. And the question is, what makes you feel great about what you're doing right now?
Yeah, it's way more internal what makes me feel great. It's more, again, going back to that, in a way, selfish thing, like I am like satisfying my curiosity and satisfying my appetite for learning, right? I feel like when I'm at an event, like people ask me like, hey, like, how do you feel like all these people being here, right? And I mean, I enjoy it, I appreciate it, but it's not like, it's this feeling, like it's not what really drives me forward, you know? So it's a weird thing to say, but it's like, you know, like, of course I appreciate it, but what I appreciate the most is not necessarily people using it, is the people to have the conversations with and to help me keep on learning. So it's a very like self inner thing that I use to make me feel great and feel positive than depending on the external, right? Mm-hmm. Which something not ultimately under your control, right?
Awesome. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. I loved learning all of this. I hope you did too.
Thank you for catching yet another episode of Dev Propulsion Labs. We at Evil Martians transform growth stage startups into unicorns, build developer tools, and create open source products. If your developer tool needs help with product design, development, or SRE, visit evilmartians.com/devtools. See you in the next.